Guardian Unlimited.
Hello, my name's John Dennis and you're listening to News Desk on Wednesday, June the 20th. The Guardian reveals today that Gordon Brown's been in secret talks with Samin Campbell about the possibility of one or two Liberal Democrats joining his first cabinet. As the prison population in England and Wales hits a record high, hundreds of prisoners are going to be released early. Rajiv Chandrasekaran's book, Imperial Life in the Emerald City, has won the Samuel Johnson Non-Fiction Prize. He talks to Newsdesk about Baghdad's Green Zone. And cricket, England have completed a 3-0 series win over the West Indies. John Henley's eschewing cricketing metaphors with his preview of the Guardian diary, as will Ros Taylor in her look at today's papers. In a week's time, Gordon Brown takes over as Prime Minister. He said he wants a government of all the talents. But in private, the PM-to-be has met Samin Campbell and talked about including Liberal Democrats in his first cabinet. That's what a well-placed source has revealed to The Guardian. Our political commentator Michael White told me what has been discussed.
It's not at all clear what they've been discussing. When I spoke to Sir Ming's old ally, Lord Kirkwood, Archie Kirkwood, used to be an MP last night, he said they talk about everything. They talk about Fife and everything. And Lord Kirkwood said, you know, we're not getting involved in discussing speculation. And Sir Ming's spokesman said later, we don't discuss rumour and tittle-tattle. But neither of them actually denied that there have been conversations. They would not go into substance. But the suggestion is, which came to the Guardian's attention, is they have been talking about serious things and ways of cooperating in a government sphere. And I put it as vaguely as that because, A, it's not clear what they discussed, or, B, how far they got with it. And there's some suggestions this morning that, you know, talk of ministers just may not work because the Lib Dems don't want to be held accountable by their own MPs or Labour MPs for aspects of government policy they don't like. And that ranges from Iraq to ID cards and 90-day detention, and not to mention nuclear power and a council tax. So last night's statement underlined very, very emphatically.
How would Gordon Brown be helped by having Lib Dems in his cabinet?
Well, I think he wants to strike a different note. He talked in his opening statement a few weeks ago about a government of all the talents. You'll probably remember in 1997 there was strong talk between Paddy Ashdown, then the leader of the party, and Tony Blair about the possibilities of cooperation or even coalition. It all went belly up when Labour got a majority of 179. If it had been a majority of 30 or 40, that might have been a different matter. So never got anywhere. And in this case, maybe Mr. Brown wants to reach out beyond his own party and say, look, you know, I'm trying to bring in all the talents. Don't forget, it's at a time of the political season when the new president of France, Nicolas Sarkozy, is doing precisely that.
Has Gordon Brown previously shown any enthusiasm for bipartisan politics?
I mean, everybody who knows Mr. Brown and knows Tony Blair, and all the listeners do by now, they've been around long enough, know that Mr. Brown is much more of a Labour tribalist by instinct and temperament in his heart than Tony Blair, who's a bit of a cuckoo in the nest. Nonetheless, two important points. One is that Min Campbell, 65 years old, former Scottish Olympic athlete, Glasgow University, who was he at university with Gordon Brown's great friend and mentor, the late John Smith, who wasn't a great sprinter, but a better drinker than Sir Ming. It's a hard school, Glasgow University, and so they've known each other a long time. So Gordon Brown, who's an MP for Kirkcaldy, who's the MP for North East Fife, well, Ming Campbell. So they're neighbours, they've known each other, they're high-minded, serious, Presbyterian Scots, if I can put it that way. And don't forget that since the year 2000 until a few weeks ago, Scotland was governed by a coalition. And who was in that coalition? Why, Labour and the Liberal Democrats.
But how would Lib Dem cabinet members in a Brown government go down with Labour MPs?
Well, I think quite reasonably there, John, you're racing ahead of yourself a bit. I have a feeling it's not going to happen that way. I don't rule it out because there's clearly something going on here and it's consistent with what Mr. Brown has said in public and what he might want to do. I have a feeling we're not going to get Vince Cable. He's the obvious case. Why is he the obvious case? Well, because he used to be a Labour councillor in Glasgow and he once contributed to a book called The Red Book for Scotland. And guess who edited that book? Why, Gordon Brown edited that book, John. So it's all sort of theoretically possible. Even Gordon Brown respects Vince Cable. He's a very clever man. He used to be the chief economist at Shell or BP. So that's possible. I just don't think it'll happen. Why? Because back to your first question, what will Labour and Lib Dem MPs think about it? Well, a lot of them won't mind, but a lot of them will mind quite a lot.
And what kind of problems might such a move create for the Conservatives?
Well, it's both a threat and an opportunity for the Tories. Most things are in life, aren't they? So the Tories would see you say to the voters, you see, they're all in bed with each other, these people. We told you that a vote for the Lib Dems was a soft vote for Labour, keeping them in power. And now they've explicitly owned up and done it.
Michael White. Now, Ros Taylor's here in the pod with today's papers. Ros, what are the Telegraph saying about delays at airports?
It says they're going to get much worse, and it says they're already getting worse at Stansted and Luton, which have installed a new, more sophisticated way of scanning people's passports. And the big news is, and you might decide whether this is worthy of a splash or not, that it will now take between 8 to 10 seconds to process each returning passenger, as opposed to the former 3 or 4. Now, in former times, that might have been cause for celebration that we were checking people's passports more carefully, but not in the Telegraph.
Now, the Independent calls for a higher tax on private equity.
Yes, this is an issue that's been simmering along for some time, and the FT and Independent both lead with it today. The Indy points out just how little tax some private equity investors pay, can be less than 10% or even hardly anything at all. And it also points out that a lot of them are non-domiciled in Britain, which means that they don't have to pay very much stamp duty on houses they buy here. And it says that's having quite a distorting effect on the property market, helping to push up prices even further.
The Times is among the papers speculating that Tony Blair will give ground in some way at the EU summit this week.
Yes, it's worried about these four red lines which Tony Blair has set out. In an effort to stress how united they are, Tony Blair and Gordon Brown made a joint phone call with Nicolas Sarkozy, the French president, yesterday. They're both pictured grinning as they talked to him. What exactly they were saying, we don't know. But the Times says there are four big issues are really too important to just be decided at Brussels, and they really ought to be put to a referendum. Whether Gordon Brown will want that, it remains to be seen.
Now, fresh violence in Iraq yesterday. A Shia mosque was hit in Baghdad.
This was a mosque in a fairly mixed neighbourhood in Baghdad, where the Herald Tribune says that Shias, Sunnis, Kurds lived alongside each other. And as a result, the bombing came as a particular shock to people living there. About 75 people were killed when a truck bomber drove his truck into the mosque complex. But the paper says, with a little bit more hope, that the local imams have been urging worshippers to worship at each other's mosques, so Sunnis going to Shia mosques and so on, and vice versa, in order to try and overcome these sectarian divisions.
Now, News Desk, of course, always the first port of call for celebrity news. And what have you got for us today, Ros?
I can reveal that Tomcat may or may not be pregnant.
Tomcat being, of course,
The Tom Cruise, Katie Holmes celebrity partnership.
As we all know.
Yes. Now, they've already had one baby. And there was a rumour in The Sun, well, there was a story in The Sun yesterday suggesting that Katie was pregnant again. But unfortunately, she was then photographed on a beach in southern France wearing the very tight-fitting swimming costume, which suggests that she isn't. So The Express has some fun pointing out how wrong The Sun story was, and The Sun has some fun pointing out just how beautiful she looks and how well-fitting her swimsuit and flattering her swimsuit is.
Now, what do the papers make of this new edict from the Pope?
This is a new 58-page edict advising drivers on how to conduct themselves in the most Catholic way possible. There's some obvious things like thou shalt not kill, which one would have thought really people didn't need to hear again. But the one that the Times focuses on is that the car should neither be an expression of power nor an occasion for sin. Now, you might speculate on how a car might be an occasion for sin. I believe the Vatican had curb crawling in mind. but whether or not it is okay to fornicate in cars is, of course, debatable. I imagine if you don't use a condom and if you're not engaged in an adulterous relationship and if it's for purposes of procreation, then it's probably fine.
No doubt all these rules apply to Pope mobiles as well. Anyway, many thanks, Ros, and don't forget, subscribe to The Wrap, our daily email review of the papers, guardian.co.uk/wrap. Between 1,500 and 1,800 non-dangerous criminals are going to be released from prison next week before the end of their sentence. I asked our Home Affairs editor Alan Travis why the Justice Secretary, Lord Falconer, has deemed it necessary to extend the early release scheme.
Well, they've come to a situation now where the prison population has been rising remorselessly in the last 18 months, and it's just begin to accelerate this year, rising at about the rate of 200 a week, until on Monday night it finally broke the 81,000 barrier for the first time, record high for Britain and amongst the highest in Europe.
And how much shorter will the sentences be of these prisoners who've been released early?
Well, the terms of this temporary home licence scheme, as they call it, is that prisoners serving 4 years or less, between 4 weeks and 4 years, will leave prison 18 days before the end of their sentence, during which time they will be under supervision by the probation service, and if they offend during that time, they'll get immediately recalled to prison. This will reduce the daily prison population by about 1,200. About 1,500 should get out next week and the week after, as the scheme starts to gather pace. And in a full year, if it lasts for a full year, then about 25,000 of the prisoners serving sentences of less than 4 years could benefit from this.
Tony Blair recently ruled out an extension of the early release scheme, so isn't this quite embarrassing for the government?
It is quite embarrassing, yes. They have set their face against, as you say, early release, and consistently have tried to claim they could build their way out of this prison crisis, which has mainly been sparked by ever longer prison sentences being passed by the courts, partly as a result of the numerous Criminal Justice Acts, 3,000 new offences created since 1997. They've tried every other option. They've tried looking at prison ships. They tried to negotiate for two prison ships, but they couldn't find them. And if they had found them, they were also trying to find a port, being prepared to have the ships moored in their port, and no port was willing to volunteer for that. They tried opening new army camps. They found a site in Dover, but the local Gurkha families of Gurkha Regiment protested about that, so they cancelled that plan. They've got a plan for 9,500 extra prison spaces to be built over the next 5 years, but it takes time to build. Even ready-to-build units or house blocks take time to move in, and they need to act in order to try and slow down this acceleration in the prison population.
Will the early release of these prisoners put the public at risk?
The argument goes that so far, the other early release schemes that are in place, home detention curfew notably, under which low-risk prisoners go home up to four and a half months before the end of their sentence, under an electronic tag monitored, and under curfew at night, that's had a success rate of about 96%. Only 4% have reoffended. And it's hoped that this temporary licence scheme would have a similar success rate in terms of reoffending. The politics are quite interesting in this announcement today. We were expecting it to happen on Thursday, but they were flushed out by a leak of the release scheme and had to have hurried meetings to agree to it at Downing Street. Indeed, Tony Blair, having, as you said, ruled it out 3 weeks ago, may have been quite a bit irritated about this. It seems as though it's almost been bounced through Downing Street and he's accepted to do it. Interestingly, Gordon Brown was the first minister to come out and support the announcement with his announcement of extra money for prison building places. It suggests to me that he was keen to see that this was something which was announced by Tony Blair before he left office, something which plays badly in the Mail and the Sun. They have front pages stories this morning calling it a disgrace, saying it's a get-out-of-jail card free and attacking it. And he was keen that this shouldn't be amongst his first acts as Prime Minister, was to let the prisoners out.
Alan Travis. Imperial Life in the Emerald City by Rajiv Chandrasekaran is up there with the greatest reportage of the last 50 years, say the judges of the Samuel Johnson Non-Fiction Prize. At an awards ceremony in London last night, Lady Helena Kennedy QC, who chaired the judging panel, said it was as fine as Hershey on Hiroshima and Capote's In Cold Blood. He told The Guardian's Lindsay Irvin where he got the title of his book.
The Emerald City was a term that several dwellers of the Green Zone began to use to describe their environs. These were people clearly who became disillusioned with what the Americans were doing inside the Green Zone, and they began to regard it as something of a fantasy land. Imperial life was thrown in, not because I believe that America went to Iraq with imperialist intentions, but the way that many of the Americans in the Green Zone conducted themselves. The Green Zone is much more, in my opinion, like a subdivision in Texas than any part of the Middle East. Americans drive around in brand new Chevrolet sport utility vehicles. They eat American food in the canteen. It's always things like hamburgers and hot dogs and pork chops and indeed pork, which is surprising to me because, you know, that's the heart of a Muslim country, and many Muslims find pork to be offensive. There's at least a half dozen bars. There's a disco. If you're bored, you can not just work out at a gymnasium. You can take salsa dancing classes. You can take Bible study classes. There's several swimming pools around which you can relax, work on your suntan. I don't mean to suggest that this is some posh resort. There are rockets and mortars that rain down on the Green Zone almost nightly, but it really is disconnected from the experience that ordinary Iraqis face. What this disconnect has done has been to convince some of the Americans inside the Green Zone that things on the outside are better than they seem, and it's resulted in a whole slew of policies that are just completely irrelevant, unnecessary, but have been cooked up in this ivory tower.
But were you surprised, nonetheless, with what you met in the Green Zone?
What I expected was the American civilians to be going out and about, to be interacting with Iraqis, to be involving Iraqis in the decision-making process. And what happened was many of the Americans wound up ensconcing themselves in the Green Zone and becoming a little deluded, thinking that the rest of Iraq worked just as well as life worked inside the Green Zone. And so instead of focusing in on the most important things, like creating jobs, increasing electricity production, providing clean water, or providing basic medical care, the Americans inside the Green Zone wound up pursuing these almost absurd initiatives, things like rewriting Iraq's tax code, writing new traffic laws, changing Iraq's copyright policies, passing a law governing genetically modified seeds. It was an exercise in micromanagement and minutiae.
Can you zero in on what the most ridiculous appointment that you became aware of while you were over there was?
I'll give you two. We sent over a 24-year-old young man who had never worked in finance and gave him the job of reopening Baghdad Stock Exchange. We sent over a 21-year-old man who hadn't even graduated from university and assigned him to the team of Americans working to rehabilitate Iraq's interior ministry. This young man boasted to an interviewer that his most meaningful job before going to Iraq was as an ice cream truck driver.
But you're also telling the story of a national catastrophe. I mean, it's the collapse of the whole nation, basically.
Much of the mess that is gripping Iraq today has its roots in poor decision-making, poor staffing, and a failure to commit the necessary resources very early on. The decisions, the mistakes the United States made back in 2003, the ramifications of that we're dealing with today in Iraq.
Rajiv Chandrasekaran, and you can hear a longer version of that interview at guardian.co.uk/books. Now, John Henley's in his luxury apartment on the Chiswick-Acton borders with the Guardian Diary. Now, John, it's always nice to report the Helpful Teenager of the Week Award.
Absolutely, John, that's right. The Helpful Teenager of the Week Award will be going from the diary this week to Frederick Mulner, aged 17, who comes from the intensive care ward of Landshut Hospital in Germany, and unplugged his neighbour's life support machine because the noise was keeping him awake, reports the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung. Mr. Mulner said he'd been trying to sleep as he recovered from a car crash, but the noise of the life support machine that was helping to keep his neighbour 76-year-old Hermann Berghoff alive kept waking him up. Luckily, the medical staff acted promptly and reconnected the machine. So hats off to Frederick there. Our intriguing local news headline of the month, meanwhile, goes to the Daily Monitor of Kampala, Uganda. Its motto is an inspiring truth every day. The headline reads, Lustful Women Jam Emergency Phone Lines. Our whole raft of awards this morning, I'm afraid. The diary's Oh My God, Can You Imagine That story of the Year Award, probably, goes to the Liverpool Echo today for the marvellous tale of Miss Amanda Monty, aged 24, who was sentenced to 2.5 years in prison by Liverpool Crown Court last week after pulling off her former boyfriend's left testicle. In his statement, Geoffrey Jones, 37, said that he had rejected Miss Monty's advances at the end of a party, and she had flown into a rage, grabbing, and we quote, my genitals and pulling hard. He added, that caused my underpants to come off, and I found I was completely naked and in excruciating pain. It gets worse, John, it gets worse. The court also heard that a friend then saw Miss Monty put Mr. Jones' testicle into her mouth and try to swallow it before choking and spitting it out. The friend then gave it back to Mr. Jones with the comforting words, this, I think, is yours. Don't know about you, John, but we're in a state of some shock just reading about that one. Now, according to the excellent publication Oral Questions for Ministers, due to be answered today, the Brunei future PM was due to announce his decision to open free cash machines in low-income areas. Yesterday, we'll be trying to find out whether he did, of course, and above all, where they are. And finally, following our absorbing item earlier this week on the Bristol car salesman, Mr. Nick Keys, Nick's wife, Diana, has written to us to point out that for some years, Nick had a colleague at Williams Automobiles in Bristol by the name of Mike Locke. So obviously, we'll be very unamused by that.
Many thanks, John. And don't forget to send John your tips for the diary, diary@guardian.co.uk. There was a 7-wicket victory for England over the West Indies yesterday in the fourth test. The captain, Michael Vaughan, said England were now on a winning streak. Lawrence Booth was at Chesterley Street. I asked him how things had changed for England since their World Cup disaster.
Well, there's always been a big discrepancy, really, the last 15 years between their performances in Test cricket and one-day cricket. Of course, the World Cup, a one-day competition, they failed in that for the four successive World Cup, but then they got back to Test cricket, their favoured form of the game, and Michael Vaughan back as captain for the first time in about 15-16 months. So apart from that, they were playing a very poor West Indies side. I think we've all been racking our brains to try and come up with a worse Caribbean team to tour England, and I don't think there has been one, really. They had one world-class batsman in Shivnery and Chanderpaul, and really not a lot else. So I think England would have been rightly slammed if they hadn't hammered the West Indies, really.
So it wasn't England playing good cricket that did it?
Well, some of their cricket was quite good. I'd say they played at about 75% of their capabilities. Some of their bowling in the first couple of tests was terrible. I mean, we all winced when Steve Harmison seemed to be retreating to the form that saw him bowl so badly in Australia. But he came good in the last test, bowled quite well up in his home ground in Durham, and the bowling came together. It wasn't a particularly polished performance by England. The West Indies were abysmal, and that allowed England really to get away with some mistakes of their own. I think they're going to have to be slightly better if they want to beat India later in the summer.
Did England ever look like losing yesterday?
No, they never looked like losing. I mean, West Indies began the day 30 runs behind with 7 wickets left, and Chanderpaul was in, and so was Chris Gayle, the opener. But you knew that as soon as one of those two got out, England really weren't going to be held up too long. Chanderpaul was last man out. He's had an incredible series, batted for over 1,000 minutes between dismissals, which is virtually unheard of in Test cricket. But once that happened, England were chasing just over 100, and that was never going to test them against a very average West Indies attack.
Michael Vaughan has stood down as one-day captain, but he'll be remembered as one of England's best ever captains, won't he?
Yeah, I mean, he's still captained the Test team, of course, and he intends to keep going for as long as possible. He really wants to regain the Ashes in 2009. That's when Australia next visit, and that's what's keeping him going. He's now won 23 Tests, I think, or 22 as captain. That's he's extending his own record almost by the game. And yes, he's, you know, some people would say that he's achieved a lot of his wins against a poor West Indies side and a few wins against Bangladesh, who really should be beaten. But the fact is, he's really taken England to new levels as a Test team. He wasn't there, of course, when they lost 5-0 to Australia in the winter, so he can't be associated with that. And it'll be interesting to see how long he can keep going.
Do England stand a chance against India?
Oh, they definitely stand a chance. I mean, India are notoriously poor travellers. The big question will be, can England's bowlers dismiss what's a pretty glittering Indian batting lineup?
That's Lawrence Booth. Phil Maynard produced today's edition of News Desk. I'm John Dennis. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Unlimited.